Let's begin. Was on the site. Oh, okay, good. They've already posted that. Great. All right, no source page for today. We're going to work straight out of the Tanakh, and everything we have is in the text of the Tanakh. So no source page necessary. We are just going to share the screen of the Tanakh itself. If you prefer to have a Tanakh in front of you, that's also good, if not preferable. We are up to chapter 4. I'm just going to put everybody on a temporary mute and feel free to unmute to participate and ask questions or put them in the chat as best I can. I'll try to address that at the end of the issue today. And once again, if you can keep your cameras on, I'm going to put you on the second monitor as I share screen. Okay, this is where we're up to, Perek Daled. Just to do a quick recap, where we left off at the end of Perek Gimel was the perspective or voice of the Sameach, the Nehenatan, the one who wants to enjoy, the one who wants to receive, the one who recognizes the divine hand in the world to such an extent that ultimately God controls the world, and therefore man's purpose is not to change or affect or implement or in any way build upon that world, but rather to receive it as it was given, because ultimately God is in control. That philosophy met a dramatic crisis moment when he realized that that's true only in the world of nature, in the world of civilization, in the world of a society. Suddenly there are good people and there are bad people, Mokoma Mishpat Shama HaRasha, Mokoma Tzedek Shama HaRasha. And if I take the approach that ultimately God is in total control, what do I do with the society wickedness that exists? And so he comes to the same conclusion that ultimately that's God's responsibility. God created the world. God will address that issue. That is for God's domain, the righteous, the wicked. God will judge in the next world. In this world, man's job is to receive, much like the animals in the creation story, in which they are there to only receive and to exist. And so his conclusion is exactly that in this world, we are not the ones to achieve justice and address the problems of the world. Rather, man is simply to rejoice and to accept the world as is. For man cannot see what will come after him. As we said, that philosophy, that perspective, that voice is untenable, it's unsustainable, and that's exactly where we're going to start in Perek Daled. But that's the voice or perspective created for us as a kind of a, almost like a straw man in Perek Gimel. And that's where Perek Daled picks up. So I'm going to read it through and then we will break it down. V'shavti ani ve'eret kol ha'ashukim asher na'asim tachat ha'shamash. I turned and I saw all of the oppression that exists under the sun. If in the previous chapter he talked about tzedek and resha and mishpat, righteous and wicked and justice, so the subjects of that oppression are referred to here as the ashukim, those who are oppressed. And so Qehelet says, I turned and I saw all of those who are oppressed. Vinei dim'at ha'ashukim ve'en lehem menachem. There is the tear of the oppressed, and there is none to comfort them. U'miad oshkehem koach. The oppressors have the strength. Ve'en lehem menachem. But there is nobody to comfort them, meaning the oppressed. V'shaveach ani et ha'metim shekvar metu. I therefore praised the dead who are already dead, min ha'chayim asher hem ha'chayim adena, more than the living who are yet alive. V'tov mishnehem, it better than both, Et asher aden lo haya, is the one who has not yet been born. Because she lo ra'at ma'aseh hara asher nasah tachat ha'shamash, because the unborn has never seen the evil that has been done under the sun. V'riti ani et kol amal v'et kol kishron ma'aseh ki hi kinat ish mene'eyu. I saw all of the toil and all of the achievement that is the result of the envy of man one to another. Gamze hevel utruach. This too is vanity and broken wind. Ksil chobeket yadav. The fool clasps his hands together. Miochelet b'saro and eats his own flesh. Tov melachat nachat memelachafnaim amal utruach. It's better to have a handful of a handful with quietness than two handfuls with labor and chasing the wind. I turned further and saw under the vanity under the sun. There is one who is alone. Ben va'ach en lo, he has neither son nor brother. In ketz l'chol amalo, there is no end to all of his labor. Gam eno lo tizba osher, his eye is never satisfied or satiated with his wealth. Ulemi ani amel mechaseret nafshi mitova. And for whom do I labor and deprive my soul of joy? Gam zehevel, or I would deprive my soul of goodness. Gam zehevel v'inyan rahu. Tovim ashnayim min achad. Two are better than one. Asher yesh lem sachar tov la'amalam. Because two have a greater reward for their labor. If one falls, the other will lift him up his fellow. But if one is alone, then if he falls, there's no one to lift him up. Even if two lie together, then they have warmth. How can one keep the other warm? And if a man attacks one who is alone, if one is attacked, then the two together can defend themselves, can protect each other. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Tov yeled misken v'chacham mimelech zaken uksil. Better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king. Shelo yada lizer od, who does not know how to be careful anymore. Ki mibeit hasuim yatzalim loch, for out of prison he came forth to be king. Ki gam b'malchuto nolad rash, and in his kingdom was born poverty. Ve'iti et kol ha'chaim ha'melachim tachat ha'shamash. I saw all of the living under the sun. Me'yeled ha'sheni she'yamod tachtav. The other youth that would succeed him. Ein ketz l'chol ha'am l'chol ha'asher haya lefnehem. There's no end of the people all of whom, over whom he was, meaning who he was king. Lo yish mechubo. They will not rejoice in him. Gam zehevel ud ayon ruach. Shmo nag lecha kasher tilecha bet elokim v'karov lishmo mitet taksilim zavach. Guard your steps when you go to God's house, for you draw near to listen, rather than to give sacrifices of fools. Ki enam yodim lasot ra, for they don't know what they do that is evil. That's the whole parak. Now, before we get to the interpretation of this parak, there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of different pieces to this chapter. I wanted to read it all through so we kind of get a sense, bird's eye sense, that we need to kind of sort out who's speaking and what, who they're speaking to and what they're saying. But one thing I want to point out is, on the one hand, this clearly is not the same voice as the previous parak. That's clear. How do I know that this is not the same voice as the previous chapter? There are two immediate tells. Then once we know who is speaking, then we can kind of figure out what he's saying. But the two immediate tells that this is not the same voice as the previous chapter, chapter 3, are, number one, the shift in person. The shift into first person. V'shavti ani ve'e'eh. I saw, I turned, and I saw the oppressed. V'shabech ani et hametim, and I praised the dead. V'ra'iti ani et kol ha'malach. I saw all the labor and achievement that is achieved under the sun. And so the ulemi ani ameluv mechaseret nafshi, for whom am I laboring and toiling and building, if not for somebody to enjoy that achievement? And so he seems clearly to reintroduce that sense of first person. The nehene, the nehenatan, the hedonist, the one who is samech, he's the receiver of the world. In the previous chapter, he certainly did not speak in first person. He spoke about God. He spoke about God running the world. Everything is in God's domain. Man has no ability to achieve or to change the world. That was the world of the previous speaker. This speaker, whoever he is, we'll identify him in a moment, clearly is focused on his own accomplishments in the world. That is one tell that we've shifted voices. And the other is the complete absence of God. God has disappeared from this chapter. Whereas the Nehenatan spoke in terms always of God does this, the righteous before God, the wicked before God, God is in control, God will judge the righteous and the God will judge the wicked. There is no reference to God in this chapter. That's number two. And number three, there is clearly a shift in focus or subject because he's talking about ma'asim, he's talking about deeds, he's talking about amal, he's talking about toil, he's talking about reward for that toil. Lemi ani amel, what am I toiling for? And so that also is a tell that he's not talking about simcha, he's not talking about joy, he's not talking about hana'ah, he's not talking about receiving, he's talking about doing, building, creating, and changing. And so that certainly is not the world of the Nehenatan. If anything, that would be the world of the Amal, who we have yet to introduce, but the one who is toiling and building and trying to create an impact in the world. That is true for every part of this parak, except one verse, which is the last verse. Shmor aglecha kasher telecha bet elokim bekarov lishmo mite taksilim zavach. Guard yourself when you walk into the temple, the house of God. Draw near to listen rather than to give it the sacrifice of fools. That's not the world of the Amal. Suddenly he's talking in second person. Shmor raglecha. He's talking to you, right? And he is talking about the house of God. These are not terms that the Amal is familiar with or frame of reference that the Amal would speak in. And if we look briefly for a second, just at the beginning of the next parak, you'll see he continues in that sense of second person advice. Al tivahel al picha, don't be rash with your mouth. Don't speak against God. Libcha al yimehel otzi devar lifnei alokim. And so clearly that's a different voice. And so here's the first time we will encounter a phenomenon we spoke about at the very beginning, which is that the chapter divisions are, I wouldn't say completely illogical, but very illogical. Meaning it's clear from this perspective that the last verse here, Pasuk Yud Zayin, is already the beginning of the next speaker. So why is it in this chapter? The chapter divisions kind of have to let them go. Just ignore them. And we're just going to work off text, and hopefully we'll have we'll structure it all, put it all together as a structure at the end. So our focus is going to be on this chapter, but only through verse 16. And verse 17, we're going to leave until the beginning of the next chapter. So I know that makes life a little more confusing and a little harder to follow in the Tanakh, but that's the way it is. All right. So having said that, let's see where he is starting from and where he ends up. Everybody with me? Okay. Let's start from the beginning. Vishavti ani veret kola ashukim v'shenasim tachat ha-shamesh v'nedimat ha-ashukim v'en lahem menachem u'miyad oshkehem koach v'en lahem menachem. I turned and saw that there is oppression in this world. There are oppressed and there are the oppressors. And there is the tear of the oppressed, and there is none to comfort the oppressed. There is none wiping away those tears of the oppressed. And all the strength rests in the oppressors, the Ein Lehem Menachem, and there is no one to comfort. And therefore, he praises the dead and praises even better than the dead, the ones who have never been born. Who and what is he talking about, and to whom is he addressing this discussion? I'm going to assume that if he says, Vishavti ani ve'ereh, he is shifting, or he is referring back to that which we just said, and essentially raising the question in the previous chapter that we ended with last week, which is in the perspective of the Nenatan. The Nenatan has just put on the table the vexing question of Kohelet, namely, who is responsible for ensuring that the righteous are rewarded, the wicked are punished, and the tear of the oppressed is comforted? Who is responsible for this world, for society? In the worldview of the Nehenatan, who is only the receiver, who can only receive from God's perspective, from God's world, from the worldview of the Nehenatan, that was in God's domain. He said so explicitly. He said in the previous chapter, probably the most important sentence in that speech is, where is it? Where did he go? Here. Amarte nibelebi et a tzaddik. Let's go back one verse. The Nenatan already put on the table that there is wickedness in society, maybe not in nature, but in society. And therefore, if God is the one who created the world and directing the world, it's a tzaddik, then God is responsible for that dilemma. And ultimately, God will hold the righteous and the wicked accountable. God will judge them. There is a time and a place for everything, and an accountability for everything. Sham, there, in that world, in the world of God. As for this world, again, to Nenatan, to be consistent with his worldview, we just sit back for the ride. So in this world, we're not obligated or able to make a change in the state of the righteous and wicked existence. That is God's domain. To which the Amal turns and says, and remember, we're going to see the exact opposite of the Nenatan, this is a world in which man can oppress another human being. And you are going to sit back and watch the tears of the oppressed fall and not offer even the words of comfort because you think that there is nothing you can do? If the world of the Nenatan was taken to its conclusion, then we have responsibility for this world in its entirety rests on the shoulders of God, and we just sit back and find our little dalet amot and sit there. That's a world that is unlivable. That is a world that is impossible to tolerate, says the Amal. And so, he says to him, there has to be some element of value, some element of spiritual existence, some element some value system to the benefit, to the, that which we receive to be able to live in this world. The notion that all that's left of existence is, in the world of the Nenatan, the concluding sentence, "Ve'raiti ki ein tov me'asher yismach adam b'masav ki hu chalko ki mi yevieno lirot b'mashiach harav." The concluding sentence, "I saw there's nothing better for man than to rejoice in his works, for that is his portion. As for what will be in the future, in the afterlife, in the world to come, in the world of God's domain, mi yevieno lirot b'mashiach harav, man can't see, and what he cannot see is not relevant to him. Our job is to enjoy what we have right now." Says the Amal, can you really justify, can you really tell me that you can enjoy a world in which there is so much suffering and so much oppression that man himself creates? Dimata Ashukim, the tear of the oppressed. And you're going to sit there and do nothing because you have some theology that says this is God's problem, let him fix it? That is not tenable. Not only is it not tenable because man oppresses man, but there's three elements in that triangle. There's the oppressor and there is the oppressed, but then there's also the silent bystander, Ein Lehem Menachem, who can't even offer comfort. That's the Ne'anatan. The Ne'anatan is not somebody who is guilty of oppression. He's not somebody who is the receiving, who is being oppressed, but he's sitting there on the sidelines, quiet as and still, and just going along for the ride. And all the power to the oppressed, Ein Lehem Menachem, there's no one to offer comfort. That's the world in which you want to live. So therefore, the Amal says to the Ne'anatan, "Mishabech ani et hametim shekvar metu." In such a world, I would rather praise those who have passed on from this world than those who are still living in it. I cannot live in such a world. And in a very cynical comment, "V'tov mishnehem et asher eden oya." In a certain sense, it's better not to have been born, because then you don't see the evil that exists. "Asher lo ra'at maseh hara asher nasa tachat hashamash." And therefore, better than the one who had to live through it and then die. So by the time I finish Pasuk Gimel, essentially what the Ne'anatan has, what the Amal has said to the Ne'anatan is, if you want to absolve yourself of all responsibility for this world, we live in a very imperfect world. We live in a world in which there are many tears. And if you are so cold and callous, the Ein Lehem Menachem, that you cannot even offer comfort to the oppressed and sympathy, then that is a world in which it is better not to exist. And ultimately, it's the same question we asked at the end of the previous year. We just asked it a little less dramatically, which is, if God is the one who is holding man accountable and man cannot do anything to change the world in which he lives, what is man being held accountable for? If the take the world view of the Ne'anatan to its extreme, we are just to receive, we cannot change. Any change we try to impact in the world is theologically a challenge to God who made the world, then what are we being judged for? He threw responsibility of justice up into the domain of God, at the Tzadik V'Tasha Yishpot Elokim. But Mishpat for what? If man is absolved of all responsibility. And therefore the Amal turns and he says, such a world cannot exist. It's not tenable. It's not livable. And so he dismisses it. And with those three psukim, he's completely dismissed the worldview of the Ne'anatan and taken the exact opposite perspective. Namely, if the philosophy of the Ne'anatan was, ultimately, God is in charge and God alone will create or recreate the paradise that once was, says the Amal, that is not God's domain, that is man. We are responsible in our shoulders and on our responsibility and on our watch. We are responsible for the world in which we live, no one else. And so the Ne'anatan and the Amal are two almost diametrically opposed perspectives. One that says God runs the world, God will judge, God will take care of it all. And one that says man is in charge of this world, almost to a denial of God, but he doesn't, that doesn't exist really in Tanakh. But to the point of responsibility for creating, for building that world where we can comfort the oppressed, where we can hold the oppressor accountable. That's a world that is vests on my shoulders, on our shoulders, not on God's. Okay? If that's true, then let's explore that world. So Pasuk Aleph through Gimel is a rejection of the world of the Nanatan. In such a world, better not to be born. The conclusion, therefore, is the exact opposite. I am responsible for this world. I'm going to build, create, change, challenge, going to establish myself in this world. And now let's explore the world of the Amal. And for the first time, we find the reference to the calling card of the Amal. Ra'iti ani et kol Amal. Right here, he is now addressing the question of the building, the toiling, the effort, the creation. What is it all for? And what is, how does it work? And so that's starting in Pasuk Dalet. Everybody with me so far? Yep. Okay. Ve'ra'iti ani et kol amal ve'et kol kishron ma'aseh. So I explored labor, achievement, and I discovered something very odd. The motivating factor behind all that man achieves in this world is jealousy. Envy. Why does man achieve? Why does man build? Why does man create? Why does man achieve amass wealth? Because he's envious of his neighbor. That's vanity. And it was for that reason, maybe, the fool, who he is now, and this is important to recognize, the term fool in this context refers back to the Ne'eneh. The Ne'enetan, the hedonist, who has his entire world view is to eat and to enjoy, the Amal calls the fool. After he rejects him, he calls him a fool, calls him the Ksil, and we'll see that term is going to be used in a number of different ways. It's used to refer to the Ne'eneh when the Amal speaks. It's used to refer to the non-wise when the Chacham speaks. Right? The Ksil is a generic term for anybody who the voice of Kohelet at this moment doesn't agree with. But in this particular case, HaKsil Chovek Yadav Ochalet Psaro. The fool clasps his hands together and he eats. And he eats his own flesh, meaning he just eats. That's what he does. Tov Meloch Hafnachat Mimeloch Hafnaim Amal Ut Ruach. Better a handful of quiet than two handfuls of labor and chasing wind. So just textually, what does that mean? So the easiest way to understand Pasuk Hei and Vav is that it's the continuation of one sentence. The fool, referring to the Ne'eneh, clasps his hands together, eats himself into the grave, or eats his own flesh, and says, right, so Pasuk Vav is a quote in the name of the Ne'eneh, that the Ne'eneh says, Tov meloch hafnachat, mimloch hafnaim, amal lerut ruach. I'd rather have a handful of quiet, without responsibility, without obligations, but just a handful of quiet, then two handfuls of labor and effort and chasing wind and broken wind. That's the worldview of the Ne'eneh. Because ultimately the Amal is a much harder process. For the Amal, you have to toil, you have to build, you have to create. And the first thing he observes is that the motivation behind it is the world of Kinat Ishmerayu is negative. The motivation behind what a person really does, what he wants to accomplish in this world in a very cynical fashion, he says, is, if you're talking about the individual and why they want to amass wealth, it's because they're jealous of the neighbor who's got more than they do. Kinat Ishmerayu. So he wants to build and he wants to do more. But that's a very negative perspective. And ultimately, there's an element of truth to that. We are motivated by a sense of looking around us and seeing what others are able to accomplish, and we want to either accomplish the same or do more. There's a great deal of truth to that. Some wanted to build a whole economic theory out of this pasuk. I'm not sure he's talking about economics, but nonetheless, There is a great deal of truth to that. There is an element of kin'ah, of jealousy in this world, and we need to recognize that and ask the question, out of something which is inherently negative, can something positive emerge? Right? If the motivation behind amal, behind toil and effort and achievement, is jealousy, can that accomplish something good if ultimately its motivation is bad? The ksil, the fool, said no. And therefore he said, I'd rather just go for the ride. Kohelet's not so satisfied with that, and so Kohelet's going to try to resolve that dilemma. Before we get to the resolution, he says, V'shavti ani vera hevel tachat ha-shamash, I then saw another source of problem or vexing vanity under the sun. Meaning, the Amal, who is addressing the question of toil, says there are problems that need to be addressed. Problem number one is motivation. Problem number two is, let's see, Yesh echad ve'en sheni. What if one is alone? There are no others. Gam ben v'ach ein lo. One has no son. One has no brother. One is totally alone. Ve'en ketz lo chalam alo, and he continues to toil to without end. Gam eino lo tizba osher, never being satisfied with his wealth. But in the end, ulemi ani amel umechaser et nafshi. Mitova, Gamzaheba Benyan Rao. For whom am I laboring and depriving my soul of any joy in this world because I'm working so hard? If there is no one to leave it to, there's no second generation, there's no child, there's no brother, there's no sibling, there's nobody to leave it to, it's just for me. Well, I'm not here forever. Gamzaheba Benyan Rao. So just to put a summary at this point before he gets to the resolution, is he's identified two problems with his own philosophy. His own philosophy is, we are responsible for this world. I need to place the world of amelut, toil, effort, labor, respond, building on my own shoulders. Otherwise, I end up in the world of the nenet, can't live there. Fine. Calls it the world of the fool. But if I want to be honest with myself and look at the world around me, there are two problems with such a philosophy. Number one is a problem of motivation. I'm motivated, driven by a desire to do more than my neighbor, to achieve more than my neighbor, to have more than my neighbor. That's very negative. That's very astute human nature, but it's very negative. And the other is that I could do all of this and then have no one to leave it to. Nobody, no continuity, no legacy. Because yesh echad ve'en sheni, gam ben ve'achein lo. I don't know if you remember, but when we look back, when we first encountered this perspective, it was back in chapter 2. And in chapter 2, Kohelet raised the same question. But there, it was, he wanted it all for himself, and he didn't even want to leave it. Le'adam sheyeh acharav, right? To whom am I toiling in effort if everything I do has to be left to lemi sheyeh acharai, right? To the one who will come after me. Le'adam sheyeh acharai, referring to his son. He didn't even want to recognize there was a son to leave it to. Kohelet has matured, right? He's moved from chapter 2, where his description of his son is the one who will come after me, to bemoaning the possibility that he could be left in a place where he wants to leave everything he's achieved and accomplished and the notion of building for something bigger. But maybe there is no other. Maybe it's just me alone. Maybe there's no son. Maybe there's no brother. Maybe there's no one to leave it to. And then what am I doing? So I have two almost conflicting issues. On the one hand, I'm motivated, says Kohelet, by kinat ish re'eu. I'm motivated by the sense of toil is driven by the desire to accomplish in this world is driven by a jealousy of the other. And at the same time, by the challenge of to whom am I going to leave whatever I accomplish? I'm only here for a temporary amount of time. Those are the two problems. Essentially, he accepts the notion that the solution lies somewhere in the self, in the sense that responsibility for this world rests on my shoulders. That he accepts. But he also accepts that in order to do and to build and create and to change, to be motivated just by the jealousy of the guy next to me, or the be vexed by the challenge of not having a legacy to leave it to, these are challenges that need to be addressed. They're not inherent in the philosophy of taking responsibility for the world, but there's problems that need to be resolved. So what's the solution? So in Pasuk Tet, for the first time, we begin to encounter the solution. In other words, up until, if I could divide this chapter, and it's a very neat, it's a very structured chapter to divide, right? The first three psukim, Aleph through Gimel, he's rejecting the world of view of the Nehne. In such a world, I don't want to live. And in verses 4, 5, and 6, he addresses the problem, the Amal, the philosophy of the Amal, which is to build and to create and to do, and says, but wait a second, what's the motivation here? Is the motivation just jealousy, or is there something deeper? And in verses 7 and 8, he addresses the other problem, namely, what's the lasting legacy of everything that I create? Or is it here today, gone tomorrow? Do you everybody see the structure? Those are the three parts that we've identified. And so in Pasuk Tet, for the first time, he begins to explore, okay, what it is that is going to resolve these two dilemmas. And he comes up with one solution to solve them both. Namely, Tovim Hashnayim Min HaEchad. Why don't I put together a cooperative? Two people working for the same goal. A cooperative, a partnership. Tovim Hashnayim Min HaEchad. Why does that solve the problem? So first of all, Ashi Yesh Lehem Sachar Tov Ba'amalam. Right, there is greater reward because two heads are better than one, as the expression goes. Right? There is more to be accomplished. More importantly, if they fall, one can help lift up the neighbor. They can support each other. They can help each other. But if there's only alone, if you're only one, then if you fall, there's nobody to lift you up. And if the two lie together, they will have warmth, they can support each other, they can provide warmth to each other. One alone cannot do so. And if they're attacked, the second one can come to his defense. In other words, the solution to my two problems identified before lie in the concept of sharing that effort with somebody else. How does it address my two issues? So what are my two issues? Number one, the motivation. Right? If the motivation behind my toil was, it's driven by jealousy for somebody else. So how does my solution address the problem of jealousy? How does the cooperative, the partnership, address the issue of motivation being one of jealousy for somebody else? Right? It's about reorienting the perspective. Tovim Hashnayim Min HaEchad, two working together. So if they're two working together, and now suddenly it's not about the jealousy of the other guy, right? The other guy is now my partner. So I bring him into a combined effort, and I learn to recognize that there's value in his contribution to me and my contribution to him. So we're not working against each other, we're working with each other. So I take that partner, that other, who's sitting on the other side of the fence, I'm making my partner, and suddenly I realize that we're working towards a goal that we share and that we can help each other. If one falls, the other can help him. If there's an attack, the other can help come to his defense. If one is cold, the other can help warm them up, right? There's value in the other beyond just the jealousy of he has more than me. Let's pool our resources. Let's work together. Okay? As I said, there's a lot of economic theory that revolves around this, but we're not going to take us off topic. That's one problem. What's the other issue we identified? Lemi ani amel, right? Who? What about if there's nobody to leave it for? Yesh echad ve'en sheni gam ben ve'ach en lo ve'en ketzu chol amalo ulemi ani mechaseret nafshi mitova. The notion of continuity, of legacy. If I don't have a child, if I don't have a sibling, if I don't have a brother, then to whom am I going to leave all of this toil that I have created? So how does two working together solve that problem? Right? How does two working together solve that problem? The likelihood of one not having anybody to inherit their accomplishments is possible. Right? Most people have families, most people have extended families. Like the likelihood of having nobody to leave it to is there. It's not impossible, but it's not high. But the likelihood of two in a partnership not having anybody to leave it as a legacy to, meaning the likelihood of two people not having a continuity, a child, a sibling, a brother, etc., or each other to leave the effort that he's accomplished, is even less likely. Right? Understand the theory? In other words, by bringing these two people together, rather than seeing the other as my competitor, I partner with them, and suddenly two together create a sense of combined purpose, combined effort, addressing the first issue of motivation. And at the same time, I now have a legacy, because in the outside chance that I don't have anybody to leave it to, the likelihood that my partner also has no one to leave it to is less likely. It's even less likely. Right? The statistics go down. However, just because the statistics go down doesn't mean that they are nothing. What happens if really two people come together in a partnership and they have really nothing? They have nobody to leave it. They have no children, no siblings, no family, nothing. The two of them together created a partnership and created an effort and a lifelong toil, and they literally have nobody to leave it to. So what's the solution? What's the solution? Expand the partnership. Go from two to three. And so, be'achut ha'mishulash, lo b'meira yinatek. The three-pronged cord is not quickly broken. Meaning, the concept, the solution, the approach to the solution works. The approach to the solution works. If you're dealing with the technicality, what if I have no children? What if I have no one to leave it to? What if the other one is achieving more than me and I kind of bring them into a partnership with me? So if those two now have a competing neighbor across the yard and they're doing more than I, so take the solution of two and expand it to three. And if that's not enough, expand it to four. And you create a pattern. And the pattern is, and this is the real point, it's a very poetic way of reaching the point, the pattern is, I'm no longer talking about what I do, my first person singular, v'shavti ani v'er'eh, or ulemi ani amel. I'm no longer talking about me. Now I'm talking about we. Now I'm talking about us. And it took the Amal, the mindset, to take the very philosophy that he's working with, which is that I am in this world and responsible for this world, and I can't live with the tear of the oppressed if I don't do something about it, says the Amal, fine. So do something. But what if I can't do enough? So bring somebody else into the partnership, and you can do more. And what if it's not going to last? Well, bring a third person into the partnership. And you know what? You keep building and you keep expanding. And before you know it, you've gone from two to three to five to 100. To 500? Two, and here's the key word. What are we looking for? To an entire society. I've essentially brought the Amal from the, if you remember back in chapter two, from the very extraordinarily self-centered world of I want it all for myself, and I don't even want to leave it to the one who'll come after me, we've matured him to the point where the solution now lies in the society as a whole. V'achuta mishulash, lo b'mirayina teik. The more people who share that vision, the stronger the accomplishment becomes. And before we get into Pasuk Gimel, which he's going to start now challenging that, I have to understand what is the solution of the Amal, and this is going to be consistent with his entire presentation, both here and the next piece, is that the Amal sees the human being, he sees man responsible for recreating paradise in this world. The Amal is responsible for recreating a world in which man is held accountable for his actions, and justice is rewarded, evil is punished, and ultimately there is a responsibility for, or there is somebody to wipe away the tear of the oppressed. That's how he starts. Who is responsible for Mishpat? Who is responsible for justice? In the worldview of the Nehenneh, previous chapter, who is responsible for justice? God. And where was God going to achieve that justice, that judgment? In the next world. Right? In the worldview of the Nehenneh, that responsibility rests on, quote, a society as a whole. Mishpat, the society as a whole. And you can't have an entire society responsible for Mishpat in the world. That doesn't work. So who is he really placing responsibility for this sense of justice and judgment in this world on? Who leads a society? Who guides a society? Who takes a society from generation to generation, if not the leadership of that society? And so suddenly, from a world in which Kohelet himself, the individual, was at the center of the universe, now the Nehenneh placed God at the center of the universe, and in chapter 4, the Amal places the Melech, the leader of a society, at the center of the universe. The Melech, the king, whoever leads the society, who brings together the powers and the forces of the entire society, that individual is responsible for this world. And he's going to get into the question of the Melech in the next pasuk. And that's why the transition between Yud-Bet and Yud-Gimel is important, because we've gone from 2, Tovim HaShnayim, to 3, Chut HaMishulash, to the Melech, meaning the one who is responsible for the leading of this society. And that's why it's important to recognize this transition. But ultimately, it is the Melech who is responsible for judgment for Mishpat. And that's very true, by the way. That's not just Kohelet. That's true in Tanakh as a whole. If I were to say to you, what is the job description of a king of Israel? What is the job description of a king of Israel? And a king, you know, we sometimes think about kingship in terms of the debate about whether we should have a king or a democracy, you know, that kind of issue. That's a contemporary issue. In Tanakh, there is no such thing as a dialogue or a debate between having a king versus having a democracy. Democracy doesn't exist at the time of Tanakh. The issue in Tanakh is whether you have a centralized leadership called a king or whether you have tribal leadership called judges. That's the only debate in Tanakh. A king is a national leader. And so the largest unit of people who can come together and create a single society under one leadership banner is not a shofet or a shevet, it's not a tribe, but it's a melech, it's a king. And the job description of the king is identified clearly in two domains. All we need to do is go back to Sefer Shmuel, where the first time we are introduced to the notion of the request to have a king. And we're not going to study Sefer Shmuel right now and whether it was a good request or bad request, but I want to know the job description of the king, right? Whether or not they should have needed or didn't need, this was the right time for a king or not. Not my issue. Well, what is the job description of a king? Says the people to, right? The people gather together, they come to Shmuel, and they said, Sima lanu melech lishofteinu kechol hagoyim. We want a king to be our judge. And they said, Tna lanu melech lishofteinu. Now, I'm going to hold a whole issue here in this chapter with regards to whether they should have had a king or not have a king, whether it was the right time. Skip it. I'm going to skip all of that. I want to go right to the end. Says the people, Hayinu kechol, gamanachnu kechol agoyim. We want to be like every nation on the planet. We want shvatanu malkeinu yetzal lefaneinu bilchamat milchamoteinu. We want a king / national leader who will do two things. Who will be the judge, meaning he will set law and order internally so that the wicked are punished and the righteous rewarded. There's a sense of law and order in the society as a whole. That's the world of the Shofet. And he will wage our wars in order to defend our people from attack from the outside. Essentially, a leader is responsible for law and order internally and protection from external forces. That's the role of leadership. The people said it, the God said it, the Navi said it. That's the role of a melech. The Shofet, and to wage wars and protect the people from attack. That's exactly how Shlomo HaMelech saw it. When Shlomo HaMelech became king, and the first thing he had when God came to him down in Givon and said to him, what is it that you want? We went through we read those chapters. I'm going to jump quickly to them. When Shlomo became king and God came to him in Givon and said to him, ask of me whatever it is that you desire. Right? And his answer is, So the good and evil, Levin ben Tovlava, issue we dealt with. But the notion of judging his people is a primary role of the Melech. That's what the Melech is. And so no surprise that Kohelet / Shlomo HaMelech understood the role of the leader of a society as the one who would establish law and order, the one who would be responsible for Mishpat, the one who would take upon his shoulders in the entire structure of leadership of the people, dealing with the question of with which Kohelet starts, right? With Kohelet, this parak starts with the question of who's going to wipe away the tears from the oppressed, who's going to bring justice in this world, who's going to hold the wicked accountable. Not the Nehenah. He's throwing all that responsibility onto God's shoulders. Then Amal says, Kohel at the beginning, he's one person. What can he do? And even if he's two people, and even if he's three people, what can he do? Oh, but what if it's this entire society? What if it's an entire group? What if I have a melech? And so for in between Pasuk Yibet and Pasuk Gimel, there is a verse missing. It's not really missing. It's the assumption that I'm going to insert into this space, and that is a paraphrase of the previous chapter. In the previous chapter, Kohelet's conclusion was, "Etz tzaddik v'et rasha yishpot elokim ki et kol chefetz v'al kol maaseh sham." The righteous and the wicked will be judged by God in the next world. There, reframe that sentence in the mindset of the Amal here, and it reads, Et tzaddik v'et rasha, the righteous and the wicked will be judged by, fill in the blank, Et tzaddik v'et rasha yishpot hamelech. Yeah. Right? The righteous and the wicked will be judged by the king. Where? Right here.
In this world.
Right here in this world. That's the chut ha-mishulash. That's the three-pronged cord. That's the society as a whole. And if the society as a whole takes upon itself the responsibility to address the issues of the oppressed and the oppressor and the tears of the oppressed, then society as a whole and responsible for that society is none other than the king himself, can ultimately lead such a society to a better, to a paradise that we can create. Okay? That's the theory. Like every good theory, it needs to be tested in practice. Okay, I'm going to stop sharing for 1 second. Like every good theory, it needs to be tested in practice. What does a king need to be able to succeed in that accomplishment? Law and order, protection from the enemies, rebuilds this, paradise in this world. What does the king need to accomplish that task?
Intelligence.
Excuse me?
Intelligence.
Intelligence.
That the people follow him.
The people, leadership.
Knowledge.
Sorry, I missed that. What was that?
Knowledge. You should know.
Knowledge. The scholarship, knowledge, wisdom. Yes, we have established that already.
Enforce.
Sorry, Brian, I didn't hear what you said.
Enforcement.
Enforcement. Police. Enforcement. Power. Right? You need power. You need the wealth. You need the resources to be able to accomplish that task. You need the structures of leadership in order to be able to hold the people accountable and to be able to reward the righteous. In short, you need a king who can have the wisdom, the knowledge, the wealth, the power, the army, the protection, all the pieces. Now, in the course of Jewish history, biblical history, can you tell me who the wisest, wealthiest, and most powerful king in biblical history was?
David HaMelech.
No. David Shlomo. Was the most spiritual.
Shlomo.
But he was not the wisest and not the most powerful. Shlomo.
Shlomo.
Nobody had the potential more than Shlomo. Everything Kohelet has just built up is exactly the world of Shlomo. He had the wisdom, he had the power, he had the authority, he had the fellowship, he had the leadership, he had everything. Except for one problem. By the time he reached the end of his life, it all came crashing down on him. And Kohelet understood that. He saw that. He experienced it. Remember, the rebellion of Yerovam ben Nevat, who started that rebellion, started in his lifetime. The end of his lifetime. And so the next sentence takes us from the world of the theory to the world of reality. Tov yeled misken v'chacham mimelech zaken uksil asher lo yada lizeher od. Better the poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king. Who is the poor and wise youth? And who is the old and foolish king? Well, the old and foolish king is, right? And I'll go one step further just to identify. Kimi beit hasurim yitzalim loch. For out of prison, he came forth to be king. Okay? So there's the youth, the young, foolish, poor, wise boy who out of prison became king. And the old, wise king who could not who was no longer careful or could not receive admonishment anymore. Yosef, right. Maybe, but Yosef would only fit the Yatzat Me'amitzasum Yatzalim. Look, you can explain the Yelim Sken V'chacham. You're not. In other words, he's talking, this is exact, this couldn't match a better description of Shlomo's crisis at the end of his life. Here is Shlomo, the old foolish king, who's no longer careful, who no longer knows how to take admonition from the Navi, who no longer knows how to worry about his wives, who are running rampant around the kingdom, bringing all their idolatry into the kingdom. And there is the Yelid Misken V'chacham, the poor, wise, youthful man who came out of exile in Egypt and rebelled against the king, Merim Yad B'melech. And this poor man, and the king who had it all. Reached a point in which he put it all on the shoulders of his kingdom and it all came crashing down on him. And out came the Yelid Misken V'chacham, out came this young whippersnapper called Yerovam ben Nevat, who's in charge of the oppressed people of his own tribe. And nobody oppressed the tribes of Israel more than Shlomo, who created a 20-year building project in which he enslaved the people from every tribe except his own, in order to build not only his temple, but also the palace of power and also all of the warehouses and all of the storehouses and all of the cities up and down the countryside. And so now it all rests on the shoulders of this kid. But you know what? Even in his kingdom, poverty developed. I saw everything that was going to happen with this young other who would succeed him. Meaning, take a look at Shlomo's life and Yeravam's life. Yeravam started with such great magnanimous references and the depiction of the people and the people's needs and to support the people. And before you know it, Yeravam created a split in the kingdom that tore away the northern tribes and that ultimately led to A, a civil war between the north and the south, and B, by the time he was done, a terrible calamity of the nations of the north coming in to conquer the kingdom of Yeravam, and ultimately cities in Israel that were destroyed, and hundreds of thousands of the army of Yeravam was destroyed in battle against the northern kingdom of Israel was not any better than Shlomo's kingdom. In fact, it was worse. And so in the end, Shlomo looks at this and says, it was a perfect theory. But the perfect theory came to a crashing end. Because nobody had the potential more than me. Tov yeled misken v'chacham mimelech zakenu ksil. But it all came apart when Yeravam took over. Ein l'ket. There's no end to the people. Yet those who came after him will not rejoice in him. He ends up frustrated. He ends up broken. He ends up devastated because all that potential was lost in the world of Shlomo. And that's where this parak ends. I asked a question at the beginning, can man create paradise alone? The whole notion of building the Beit HaMikdash, which was to restore the notion of Gan Eden, was to restore the temple. Man, we had this whole discussion about the role of the temple of Gan Eden, the temple as a kind of a model of Gan Eden. It kind of models the notion of what the purpose of the human being is, to recreate a world in which man can live in a society and God's presence is able to enter into that society. So the Nehenes said, it's all in God's hands, right? God will bring back paradise. God will bring the temple down from heaven in a pillar of fire. And the Amal says, no, we have to build it. Okay, you want to build it? You want to build it? Here's Shlomo Melech. He built it. Shlomo built it. And what happened to it? Before you know it, in one generation, it all came crashing down because Shlomo himself was unable to restrain himself or to be careful or to take admonition, however you want to translate the phrase. And so at the end of chapter 4, we end up with two visions or two views of different perspectives, diametrically opposed perspectives, on how to create a world in which man is accountable for his actions. Is it on God's shoulders? Is it on man's shoulders? Who is responsible for Mishpat? Who is responsible for rebuilding paradise in this world? God or man? Both perspectives fail. And there obviously is really only one answer, which is, what would you answer? How would you answer the question?
Partnership.
For that partnership, we need to wait till we get to chapter 5. And when we get to Parakeh, we'll see how the partnership is defined in terms of the variables established to date between the Neneh and the Amal. Chapter 5 will be our first introduction to the worldview of the Yireh Elokim, the one who fears God. That's coming. So that will be Bezrat Hashem next week. Okay? So that's more or less where we're at. It's a short paragraph with a short overview. I hope you understood where I was trying to go. This will be available on the website if you want to do a quick review of it before next week. And with Zat Hashem next week, we're going to start chapter 5.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
No problem. Let me just do a quick look of questions.
You know,
yeah.
Question. If Shlomo HaMelech, the wise man, wasn't able to do it,
mm-hmm.
and he failed, so who cares? I mean,
so who can succeed?
We are only human with our faults and with our temptations. Yeah.
Yeah, we are all human. And you know, is there any guarantee of success? Yes, I think there is. But I think the mistakes of Shlomo we need to recognize and address. I've often said that Tanakh does not chronicle the good stories, only the bad stories. Right? Tanakh is a book that tells us where we went wrong. Never really tells us where we went right. That's not because we never did go right. That's because the concept of positive reinforcement that doesn't exist in Tanakh's time. And so the idea is that we learn from those mistakes so that we can improve. But we're in this for the long haul, not the short haul. So in the long view of history, we've come a long way in terms of understanding where David was at, where Shlomo was at, and hopefully to build and to do a better job moving forward. We're still getting there. Bezrat Hashem. Bezrat Hashem. All right.
Thank you. That was great. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You reviewed some things in the beginning about some messages.
Say that again.
You said something in the beginning of this year. I missed something about the classes being missed. And
oh, yes. November 21 and 28. I am traveling to Israel. So I will not, those are days in which I'm not in Israel, meaning I'm either traveling or I'm on a mission. So I will be unable to be available to teach those 2 weeks. I think the dates are on the website, but it's November. It's two Tuesdays in a row, November 21 and November 28.
And there was something before that you were going to say? Didn't hear the before that.
That I don't know, but otherwise we are good to go.
Okay. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Everybody in Israel, especially, should be safe. You should be well, and then we should have smachot together.
Amen.
Be well.
Amen.
Amen.